The other two defendants are her husband, who's represented by Letitia Canones, and Mr. Gilbert Isgar, who's represented by James Scott Sullivan. I will, as you know, take 5 minutes, and then Ms. Canones, 5 minutes, Mr. Scott, 5 minutes, and then he'll do five. Well, they split, actually changed rebuttal slightly. But I'll try to be brief, to the point. From my client's perspective, this case is about a young mother of two and her husband and their law firm, which doubled as a fee title business, which because of some transactions that occurred between August of 04 and June of 05, they were spotlighted by the U.S. Attorney's Office. And over the course of a three to four year investigation, and the scrutiny they came under, they ultimately were indicted on a number of counts that arose from what you might call a classic mortgage fraud scheme case. Ultimately, they were convicted of conspiracy, mail fraud, wire fraud, money laundering, and related charges. This net also snagged Mr. Isgar, who's a home developer, a home builder. My clients were indicted right on the eve of the statute ending, which they believe is key, on March 25th of 2010. It was actually one day before the statute ran. This appeal is a product of my client's contention and her belief that conceptually, factually, and legally, her case was put into the wrong framework. And we tried to express that through the various arguments we made in our brief. She believed it started at the grand jury level with misrepresentations that were made there by the special agent, which she attributes to the prosecutor under the case law, because the law didn't see him any different.
Sort of fundamentally, wasn't there evidence that she participated in a scheme whereby prices were inflated and the profits from that went to her and her husband?
That's the fundamental allegation, Your Honor.
But wasn't there some evidence of that sufficient for a jury to find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt? And that there's not really place for us in that framework, is there?
Well, that depends on how you look at the issue. From their perspective, because of what occurred before the grand jury, because of how the case was presented, because of some of the misrepresentations, they didn't get a fair grand jury and should not have even been indicted. And then, as you know from reading both the indictment and the overt acts that were alleged based on a prior conspiracy, as well as reading the jury charge, they believed that the prior conspiracy was manufactured by the government's conduct, and that the overt acts were canceled out by the one overt act on their part, which showed there was no unity of purpose and no common design as it pertained to the conspiracy.
You mentioned one. Wasn't there a series of transactions that your clients participated in?
I'm saying
you mentioned one overt act. Wasn't there a series of transactions?
There were a series of transactions, but as the facts would show, they did not get what would be called the attorney's fees that Your Honor referred to earlier on each one. In the majority of those transactions, in some of those transactions, they just made their title fees.
But is that if they knew that the transactions were fraudulent, does it matter what they got out of it?
Well, they believe that the only fraud that entered into that transaction was the result of two felons who they became associated with and didn't know how they were conducting their
Robinson part. And the other individual. Robinson.
Highland and Robinson.
And Island.
I'm sorry?
Robinson and Island.
Robinson and Island. Exactly. And as a matter of fact, neither one of those guys made anything from the transactions. They didn't serve as brokers on the transactions. And it turned out that the information they supply and that they put into, according to the first transaction, and according to Gary Robinson's testimony, Mr. Island was the one putting the false information in most of those transactions. And so what I was trying to focus the court on is that as soon as my client found out what was going on, they did a wire recall order. That's the most prominent overt act there was. On April 29th of 2005, they tried to to recall the results of this transaction because they found out what this guy was doing. At that point, if we don't say there's no unity of purpose, if we say there's no common design, we can at least say at that point that prior conspiracy ended.
Okay. Thank you. Your time's up.
Okay.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you,
Your Honor. It goes fast.
It does.
Okay, Ms. Quinones.
May it please the Court. Due to the limited time that I have of 5 minutes, I want to go directly into the issue that I believe is most relevant to this Court, and that issue would be whether or not there was sufficient evidence to support a guilty verdict of money laundering in counts 13 through 19 of the indictment. In the indictment, count 13 through 19 encompasses the conspiracy to commit money laundering under 1956H and money laundering itself under 1957-2. Those counts are dealing with specific financial transactions, and that's key. Which financial transactions are we speaking of? And if you look to the indictment, the specific financial transactions that we're speaking of are the wire transfers from First Southwestern Title into the IOLTA account of Vincent Aldridge. That's important that we hone in on what those financial transactions are. Now that we know what the financial transactions are, we need to decide, based on the Supreme Court decision in Santos, whether or not they were profits or whether or not they were gross receipts. I would also direct the Court to persuasive authority under Cloud 680 F3rd 396. Now, if we look to these transactions in regards to the transfer from the title company to the IOLTA account, what we're able to determine is that the government did not prove that they were, in fact, profits.
Don't we have a contradiction here in terms of the testimony on that point? In Santos, you pointed out Justice Stevens's comment concerning, revenue that is used to pay essential expenses is not proceeds within the meaning of the statute, which I think what you hinge your argument on. But in this case, wasn't there testimony from the government witness, I believe Agent McCallum, that Vincent, your client, admitted that the money was pulled out of the loans was not payment of any expenses?
No, Your Honor, I would beg to differ and point the Court to Agent Dimmert's testimony, and she testified, in fact, that yes, there were transfers into the IOLTA account. However, out of the IOLTA account, Vincent Aldridge paid the investors. He paid other players. In fact, she detailed in her testimony that $30,000 was sent to Ms. King, who was an investor. $20,000 was sent to the Shields, who were also investors.
But, I mean, he kept some of it. And why isn't that profit?
However, he kept some of it, and he kept it by transferring into his managing account. And the key is that we must look at is that the transaction that was alleged in the indictment does not prove profits. If the government had alleged the transfer from the IOLTA account into his personal account or from his personal account into the investment account where he put $100,000, then their case would have been made. However, that is not what they alleged in their indictment. The financial transaction they alleged in their indictment was, in fact, from the title company to the actual IOLTA account. And in Santos, it defines profits as profits is something that is left over after the expenses of the crimes are paid.
If money goes to, say, an entity that you believe didn't do any work to receive that money, then how is that money classified?
Well, that wasn't alleged in the indictment, Your Honor. I believe you're speaking about the monies that went to Superb Construction. That was not alleged in the indictment. Counts 13 through 19 only list the financial transactions from the title company to the IOLTA account.
The money had first come from the lenders into the title company, right?
That is correct. And that's I apologize.
Then that money was taken, it went from the title company to the IOLTA. So whatever he kept was profit. In other words, it didn't matter how many banks he transferred it to after that, whatever he kept out of those proceeds was profit for him.
And I agree with you, Your Honor. However, that's not what the government alleged in the indictment. You have to allege whatever conduct.
Well, as soon as it went into his IOLTA account and he kept it for himself, it was profit for him.
He didn't keep the money from the IOLTA for himself. All of that money was not kept for himself. In fact, Santos...
But some of it was.
Some of it was after another financial transaction was made, but that financial transaction was not alleged in the indictment. Keep in mind that Santos states that there are going to be a cost of any type of criminal activity. There's always a cost associated with that.
But what I'm saying is some of the money left in the IOLTA account ended up in his pocket.
But you have to key in, it's important that the court understands, you have to key in on the financial transaction that made that happen. Otherwise, every criminal who does any type of disbursement to himself or any other recipient will be guilty of money laundering. And Santos specifically states that it has to go further than that. You can't say just because a criminal paid himself or other recipients that he's guilty of money laundering. You have to show specifically that those are, in fact, profits. In fact, Santos states that it understands that it's putting a harder burden on the government. However, defendants' rights are paramount in regards to how hard the government has to work to prove the case.
Isn't that a factual issue? I'm sorry, your time is up. Isn't that a factual issue on whether or not this all occurred, that you have one version of the evidence, government has another one? It doesn't have to be direct proof. It could be circumstantial evidence to lead the jury to conclude that.
But there was no circumstantial evidence that was presented in regards to the transfer or the financial transaction that occurred from the title company to the IOLTA account.
Okay, Ms. Canales, you've reserved time for rebuttal. We appreciate it. All right, Mr. Sullivan.
As I've listened to the arguments preceding my presentation, I think it's four points to quickly make about Mr. Iskar. Mr. Iskar made no profits here. As a result of this,
he wasn't charged in the money laundering, was he?
Off the top of my head, I think he was, but I cannot remember if he was or was not. But I'm also making the point because I think that also goes to intent.
I thought Waterford made between $30,000 and $60,000 for each sale. Is that true or not?
But it was dispersed back through a disbursement form back to the rest of the, back to various entities. He did not keep that money. It was dispersed back in to either a construction company or be it at one time the lawyers.
What was his gain off the transactions?
None.
Nothing he made. He built these houses and sold them and didn't make a dime on any.
The only thing, and Judge Lake, I think, distinctly put it, he got to move his houses a little bit quicker.
Okay, but he made money off the houses, didn't he?
That's correct. He would make... In other words, to the extent we say these properties are overvalued, he made no money. He made back what would be the fallback but for over appraisals, which incidentally, one thing we submit doesn't exist. He still stuck with that which he would ordinarily get to the extent in this case they allege these properties are over appraised.
Yeah, but I mean, we don't need criminals to be intelligent. They just need to be criminal. And so the fact that he may not have made as much off of this as he could have, if he's trying to move his houses fast, you know, there's a lot of people out there, builders out there, who have homes sitting for years and they're not getting their money out of them. So if that was his motive, was just to move it faster and he could have made more off this crime, I mean, that to me, that just doesn't seem very persuasive.
Well,
your better argument is he didn't know what was going on.
And I agree with that also.
How can we look at this evidence and say Iskar just is really an unwitting dupe in this scheme of the Aldridges and everybody else?
And I think it starts with one of the government's witnesses. One of the government's witnesses, an IRS agent, was asked specifically, what is the seller's duty at closing with respect to disclosing these transactions that may be caused by an overinflated property? And by the way, we are clearly alleging they didn't call an appraiser ever. They simply relied on the fact that extra money was floating around that causes a belief that they were appraised.
And your client's statement.
And I disagree, Your Honor, because my client's statement is closer to being one of the most honest statements in this case. If I am asking in my house 5 years ago in 2007, and I didn't say we were inflating prices, I'm lying. That's the truth, what he said. And that was, there was overinflating going back on then, back then. We know that now. He said it in hindsight.
Okay, but the construction of kind of this, I mean, you're putting your spin on it. The jury can put the opposite spin, that he was inflating it back then, you know, on purpose to help this scheme with the Aldridges to move his houses faster, et cetera. I mean, that's what juries are for. They sort through this kind of ambiguity, and they make a decision, and we're not in a position to make a better one.
But there's no ambiguity to start with, Your Honor. There's no place of evidence where actually someone said, these are inflated.
We were inflating them. I mean, you're saying he means now I realize that I was doing that, but I didn't know it then. I think an equally or even better inference from that is he knew it then, and why is he doing it?
And I think part of it is in the word doing that. He wasn't even responsible for the appraisal.
But he's sending in.
Wait.
He's sending in construction invite.
I think Judge Owen's trying to speak.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I thought there was evidence that he directly had something to do with changing the contracts on these new houses, the repairs, you know, like to the tune of $60,000 for these new houses, and that was that they, quote, inflated, unquote, the prices.
I don't believe he had a direct role in that. The only role he had is that as part of closing, he would come in and sign a disbursement form taking money that would have, on some documentation, appear to be his, but in order to give it transparency, which is along the lines of innocence, he would sign a disbursement form back into other entities within this group.
Obviously, what it seems to be, like Judge Haynes mentioned, that there seemed to be a different spin on the evidence. Your client, according to testimony of government agent McCullum, allegedly told McCullum that these inflated prices were hidden through unnecessary construction invoices or amendments attached to the sales contract, which is what I think Judge Owens was trying to bring out. Isn't it simply a variance on how you interpret?
And once again, we don't submit it's a variance when the, and I'm aware I've got a red light. May I finish the question?
Go ahead.
When the tax agent says it's not the seller's duty to do anything about that, this is not an omission case. When that agent gets on the stand and says, I don't think there's a duty, I'm not even sure. And that's how they're trying to connect my client to a crime. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. You've saved time for rebuttal. All right. Ms. Wilson.
May it please the court. Each defendant here played a pivotal role in this mortgage fraud scheme, as evidenced by the paper trail and witness after witness testimony. There's ample evidence to support the jury's verdict here.
I'm really interested in Mr. Isgar because I get what the Aldridges did. I'm having a little bit of trouble completely understanding what he did, other than him saying 5 years later, you know, we sort of inflated or whatever. What did he do that was criminal?
Isgar knew about and willingly participated in this scheme. As Robinson testified, you needed a builder to work the scheme, and Isgar was at the center of it. Without him, there could be no scheme.
But how do we know he wasn't just an unwitting dude?
What we know because
shows that he was a knowing participant in the fraud.
We know for several reasons. One, all of these homes in Houston were built and sold by his company, Waterford, in which he was a 50% owner. And what's critically important here is Isgar wasn't just a builder. He oversaw the daily business operations of the corporation.
We really need you to get specific, very specific. Tie him to this scheme.
He signed the documents. He also brought the added expertise of being a real estate agent. And while he did not act as a real estate agent here, he knew exactly how these transactions are consummated. And what he did is he signed off on these false HUDs, if you will, and what was involved there were construction amendments for brand new properties. And that doesn't make any sense. These were luxury townhomes or condominiums, whatever you want to call them. They had granite and all these fancy things.
But I mean, if I'm playing the devil's advocate, that's right. You know, rich people often want even more stuff, you know, so they got a granite countertops. They want to also put in some, you know, oven from France or something. I don't know that the fact that you have a luxury home means people can't make further improvements to it. And in fact, that's the price, you know, group that can do that, as opposed to a low-income housing project.
Well, that may be true, Judge. With all due respect, there's no evidence of that. And more importantly,
what I'm saying is you are implying from the fact that there's going to be additional construction on a new home that is alone is a badge of fraud. And I'm countering that. I'm saying I don't know if that's a badge of fraud or not. How do we know that it is?
Well, how do we know that occurred? The point is there's no evidence in the record indicating that there was any actual construction going on. What we do know
is... How does Iskar know that? How does he know that they're not going to come in and take the granite countertops and put in marble from Italy or whatever?
Well, Iskar, as he told the FBI agent, the prices had been slightly inflated. And as much as he wants to argue that it was contextually an afterthought, that's not what the testimony says, and it's not how he explained it. In fact, he also said that he had made a disbursement to Vincent. And the reason that's interesting is because Vincent bought a property himself. And what differentiates that transaction from the others is there were conflict of interest issues. So that meant Tori and Vincent couldn't participate in the paperwork and whatnot. So you had to go behind the scenes. And if you look at the exhibit, the colorful exhibit, I believe it's 30, it shows that Iskar paid Vincent $81,000 approximately the next day. And he admitted to Agent McCollum that the fraud was hidden in the amendments to the sales contract and construction invoices, even though the property...
Wait a minute. What evidence is there that was improper to pay Vincent $81,000?
Because if you look at the whole, the totality of the evidence here, which the jury did, and the jury was entitled to weigh, the jury could tell that this was highly inappropriate. He told Agent McCollum that he didn't know what superb construction was, yet he had written checks. He also, more importantly, one thing that's very important for this court to realize is these properties were closed 1, 2, 3. You had straw purchasers closing one, I believe it was it, within 16 days, closed a few properties. Another closed a few within a couple weeks. Iskar saw that. That doesn't make sense. These documents are saying that, you know, that all these things on the HUDs need to, or I'm getting, excuse me, that the HUD shows all this information. But what he sees are his properties closing, if you will, 1, 2, 3. That's a huge red flag. And the reason we know that was part of the fraud is that way, as the jury was told, the lenders would not be able to figure out what was going on, because when they pulled the credit reports and whatnot, these representations of primary residence and what have you would not show up. And
I've got a question. All right, so Iskar saw, for example, if someone bought two or three of these homes, he saw their names on the two or three different HUDs and saw the representation by one person that they were going to be the primary resident of two or three different homes. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, can you say that one more time, please?
Is there evidence that Iskar saw paperwork from the people who were buying two or three homes?
Yes, he signed off on the HUDs.
Right, and their names were on it, and he would have seen that they were representing that they were going to be the primary resident of two or more homes.
The HUDs wouldn't necessarily reflect that, but what he saw were these properties being purchased and closed within a very short time. And that...
Would he have had knowledge that there were representations made that one person would be occupying more than one of these as their primary residence?
No, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. That would have happened at the closing. So, no, there's no indication of that. However, as in any...
I'm not really understanding why closing on housing quickly. I mean, here you are a builder, you think you've built a nice development, and people wanting to buy it. I mean, that's kind of good. I don't really understand why he should suddenly go, oh, my God, for me to sell a house, it must be fraud.
Well, because while that alone may not prove conspiracy, what we have is Robinson saying how important it was that a builder inflated the price. Down the road, we have Iskar admitting to the FBI agent that's in fact what happened. Now, if Iskar was innocent, surely he would have said to Agent McCollum, I didn't know these properties were inflated. I didn't know about these construction amendments. I didn't know anything. I was an unwitting dupe.
Who were the construction contracts with? The construction invoices that were attached to the sales contracts, who were the parties to those?
Well, Superb Construction, which was a false corporation, was part of that. Now, in relation to the Island people, the Island and Robinson people, there was also, I believe, another construction corporation. But here, it was Superb Construction, which Vincent formed at Robinson's, or I guess Island's request, but it was in Robinson's name.
Judge Owen, go ahead, and then we'll get Judge Lamell.
Is there evidence that from which the jury could infer that Iskar knew these were phony construction invoices?
Well,
illegitimate companies.
Again, he tells Agent McCollum he didn't know what Superb Construction was, but there's evidence that checks went to, at least I believe it was two checks, went to Superb Construction. And the jury looked at the totality of the circumstances, the association with other people, and while in conspiracy, mere association isn't enough, there's also, when the jury put all of this together, there was an indication of Iskar's knowledge. And the opportunity to exonerate himself, if you will, was when he spoke to Agent McCollum, and he didn't. What he said is, I shouldn't have given that money to Vincent. He didn't say Vincent deserved the money or somehow or another it was justified.
Was that the same money that was not disclosed in HUD statements? And if so, who's responsible for preparing those HUD statements?
Well, the HUD statements largely were prepared by the Aldridges, specifically Tory. And so what we have is it's a group of people working together.
All right, but I want to be, again, let's keep to the point and specific. There were statements provided to HUD. In those HUD statements, were there things that were excluded from there that you believe was part of this overall conspiracy?
Yes. And disbursements were not disclosed. And the jury heard a lot about that in relation to a lot of things were hidden from the lenders. The title files showed amendments and things of that nature, but the information that went to the lenders hid various...
And who hid that? I mean, what evidence is there to show that the Iskars, the Aldridges, you know, all knew that these things were supposed to be in there and they weren't in those HUD statements?
Because we have, among other things, in addition to the paper trail, we have witness after witness who testified that they only made a certain amount of money or they had a certain amount of assets, and those were manipulated. Salaries were inflated, debts were hidden, representations of primary residence were made. All of that was to induce the lender because these lenders were making 100% loans. And so that the documentation was manipulated in that regard to hide all that information.
Let me ask you this. Where would your case be if you didn't have the Southwest Tyler, I forget the name of it, those documents that nobody could authenticate as business records?
Well, as I set forth in the brief, I believe those records were admissible, but if the court were inclined to find that there was harmful error in that regard, you still have the lender's files and you still have the witness's testimony. And as again, witness after witness testified about the fraud, that they didn't make this amount of money and that they didn't intend to live in these residences and things of that nature, which I set out in detail in the brief. And in relation to Tory, there was a tremendous paper trail. And the witnesses easily tied her to this fraud.
Can you respond to this idea that if she was tied to the Eiland sort of Robinson fraud, then she disavowed herself of that before being within the 5 years of this wire recall or whatever, and that she sort of rejected and renounced the conspiracy such that between limitations and the renouncement, you can't get to her?
Well, first of all, I don't think that's an issue on appeal. I don't think that was adequately briefed or adequately presented.
I mean, that's the argument I understood from her brief. So,
but secondly,
I don't know if it was adequate, but I got it.
But the district court did not. The district court found that to be of no consequence either, and readily disposed of the statute of limitations issue.
Well, no. What I'm saying is, it's a bit of a, as I understand, it's a little bit of a pairing of the two. What she's saying is, maybe she did something wrong with Eiland and Robinson outside of the 5 years, but then she renounced it with this wire recall and so on, and sort of withdrew from the conspiracy, and that she wasn't allowed to fully develop that in the trial court. And so that if that withdrawal occurred before the 5 year mark, then she's okay. Maybe I'm doing something wrong with her argument, but that's my understanding of the argument.
I don't think the evidence bears that out at all. And one point is that Judge Lake found there was one overarching conspiracy, but alternatively, that if that was not the case, then there were two conspiracies. And within the applicable time frame, Tory's hands are heavily involved in this
fraud.
Give
me some examples of that.
Well,
within the 5 years.
Tory meets with some of these straw purchasers, and then she gets accurate information, yet prepares documentation to the effect that will induce the lenders to fund 100% that is full of falsities, whether they be falsities that are overt or falsities by omission, meaning active representations or omissions in that regard. There is nothing in the record, to indicate that Tory ever withdrew from this conspiracy. She was at the heart and soul of it as well. Tory had a finance background and used it, her mortgage background as well. She helped to inflate the prices to obtain the money and the property. She helped use the straw purchasers. Many of them met with her on several occasions. And again, they falsified or hid the information to obtain the overfunded loans. And they submitted, she was instrumental in submitting the invoices for construction and the non-existent attorney's fees. She and her husband were both actively involved and played major roles in that regard. In fact, I think one thing that bears mentioning, although the government strongly believes that the motion for new trial is irrelevant here because it's untimely, it bears mentioning that Judge Lake spent 63 pages in responding to the motion for new trial in an order that painstakingly responded to almost all of these arguments. And one of the arguments that's very important to the government here is that the court stressed its high degree of personal knowledge about this case. It looked at all the grand jury records. It sat through the trial. It ruled upon motion after motion, both pre-trial as well as after. And it found nothing was wrong with the trial. There was not tainted by any false testimony, money, any governmental misconduct, or anything else. It did not find McCollum's testimony was false, and it devoted 9 pages to rejecting the grand jury perjury claim, and even found that, given the fact that Tory was found guilty, that effectively erased it. But moreover, this court should not allow Tory to tarnish the prosecutor's reputation with unsupported accusations.
Would you address Vincent's money laundering argument?
Yes, Your Honor. The Kennedy case is very instructive in this regard. The money laundering crimes here were distinct from the fraud crimes. A wire fraud, Kennedy made very clear, is complete when it's consummated. And in Kennedy, as in here, when the lender transmitted funds. So here it would be when they were transmitted to First Southwestern. just as they were in Kennedy to, I believe the corporation was LTCS. When those funds were transferred, the wire fraud was complete. As Kennedy said, if the entire scheme had come to a halt upon receipt, they're still guilty of wire fraud. And that's the same situation here. Now, what happened was once First Southwestern got all of that money, they started moving it. And it was moved into the IOLTA and some other things. Some of those proceeds went for personal expenses, if you will, fine dining and things of that nature. And while some of them were used to pay some of the straw purchasers and some were used to pay some of these mortgages, Kennedy had a similar situation. Kennedy found that these payments were bonus payments to induce the people to invest again, which is exactly what happened here. And Kennedy also found that the money that was moved to the shell corporations were promoting new fraudulent loans, which is essentially what happened here. And so Kennedy made a huge distinction between lottery situations, which are circular, if you will, the illegal fraud, versus the wire fraud, which is complete upon receipt of the funds.
I'm talking about money laundering. Will you address money laundering?
I'm sorry, I don't understand. I thought that's what I was doing.
Well, wire fraud I thought was different than money laundering.
It is.
Are you saying the fraud was the transmission to First Southwest and then the laundering was going from Southwest to the IOLTA,
yes.
Blah, blah, blah?
And that's what Kennedy talks about, that there is no merger issue, which is what the Santos case that Vincent was discussing. And here, it's not the same transaction. So what they did is they then moved that money to launder it. And another point that Kennedy makes is not only the difficult application in this regard, but Santos was a very narrow factual setting. But if I understand, Judge Owen, your question, the laundering occurred once First Southwestern moved that money into the IOLTA and things of that nature, which is set forth in Government Exhibit 30.
Okay.
Okay. Any closing thoughts?
So, in any event, I believe that the government's brief sets forth all the other arguments in detail, and unless this court has any additional questions, the government will yield the small remainder of its time.
Extra 15 seconds. Thank you. All right. Ms. Quinones, you're back up.
I would like to go directly into the government's contention that there is no merger problem. Specifically, Santos states, whenever payments for expenses of a crime are used in any financial transaction, a merger problem exists. It is clear from the alleged conduct in count 13 through 19 given by Agent Demmert's testimony, expenses were paid out of that account. If expenses were paid out of that account, Santo and the Supreme Court of this United States says a merger problem exists. Now I want to talk about Kennedy and distinguish it from the case that we have at bar. Kennedy deals with, it's important that it notes that Kennedy made payments on newly acquired mortgages. Also, they made bonus payments to the investors to encourage them to invest again. We don't have that kind of conduct here. Therefore, it's distinguishable. Also, the government wants to hone in on the fact that the crime was complete at the time that the money was transferred. In fact, the government states in its response that once the wire fraud was complete, the disbursement to the lenders at First Southwestern, that there could in fact be money laundering. But what the government is forgetting to address is that you still have to address the issue as to whether or not those proceeds were profits or gross receipts. Just because the crime is completed at the time the money is transferred does not negate the issue of determining whether it's profits.
I think the merger issue is, I mean, our case of Garland versus Roy goes through Santos and says the merger problem is the problem. And that's why we have this dichotomy between gross receipts and proceeds.
Well, I believe the merger problem, in my opinion, based on my reading, is really a two-part deal, and that, one, you have to determine whether or not the crime is complete at one point, let's say the wire fraud, and then further transactions can then later prove money laundering. That's one part of the merger problem from what I get from Santos. The second part of the merger problem is to determine whether or not proceeds that were used in any alleged financial transaction is profits or gross receipts. It dictates specifically gross receipts are used to pay expenses. He paid expenses. Dimmer said that in the alleged transaction.
Sorry, you've got a red light.
Okay.
We could probably discuss this case at much greater length. We appreciate you. All right, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, I certainly concur that I wish I had more time. This is just an interesting case. It has lots of aspects to it. I think I should just try to hit the main three. My client didn't do the appraisals.
Why didn't your client protest his innocence in this FBI interview? I mean, it sounds like he sort of hung himself more than anything else.
You say protest his innocence. I would have to give an overall response to that. He had no, obviously had the right to remain silent.
Right, but he didn't remain silent.
And
he talked, and what he said was inculpatory. Why didn't he say, I don't know what you're talking about. I thought the Aldridges were these nice, noble attorneys, and I had no idea there was a fraud, and I'm sorry, and what can I do to help?
Assuming it's inculpatory, so that I follow the argument the court's making.
Okay.
And that is that this is a bold confession. Okay, we inflate.
Well, I don't know that it was a bold confession, but he did not deny the crime. That's the argument that the government's making. He instead said things about the slightly inflated and I shouldn't have done the $80,000. If he's going to talk, then they can hold what he says against him.
Absolutely.
Why didn't he protest his innocence? Well, I'm asking you.
And I think by and large, through his silence, he did protest his innocence without giving a bold statement or being required to say, look, I'm not guilty of any criminal behavior. But I do note this, Your Honor. When what he was saying about the appraisal, and that's why I think he said perhaps they were slightly inflated, and that was something he didn't even have a duty to be involved with. If I could give an example.
What about the check to Superb Construction?
Okay. And that within itself is a situation, Your Honor. In fact, it leads to the point I think that's important. And that is if a group of investors, a group of buyers, or a title company comes to someone and say, we're going to give you so much for your house, you just need to give $70,000 of it back to us. Okay? Because I think that's what the court is saying. The crime starts to take place if you get if someone goes and inflates the property, and you're a party or some way aid or accomplice in that inflating. My client did none of those things. This construction company exists on paper. At least my understanding of the evidence was it did exist on paper. We never found the physical location for it, but it did exist on paper, i.e., I think there were some Secretary of State documents. I do apologize about that, Judge Owen. I'm not sure if that was specifically in this record. But at the same time, our submission is that's not against the law. And I think they made that point before the grand jury.
Trying to get a question in.
I do apologize,
Jeff. If you have a red light, let her ask her question. You'll answer it, and then we'll be done.
Okay.
My point is he said, never heard of Superb Construction, yet he wrote two checks to them. And what is the evidence? What does he say about what those checks were for?
Oh, I think there's no evidence of what he knew that check was for. That is correct, John. I have to agree by saying there was no evidence via the government or via the defense that this is going specifically for this.
Okay. Well, your red light's up. I want to thank all the attorneys for excellent arguments. We appreciate it very much. Ms. Quinones, we know that you're court appointed. We appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment. And we appreciate all the lawyers' willingness to represent their clients so ably, and we have your case under submission. Thank you.
Thank you.